Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
The people and projects trying to make our world a better place.
I just saw the problem and I knew that there is a way we can use technology to solve it.
People fixing the world from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Monday, the 8th of April, these are our main stories. Israel says it's withdrawn ground troops from southern Gaza to prepare for future operations, including in the overcrowded town of Rafah. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog says the Zaporizhia power plant in Russian-occupied Ukraine has been hit by the worst drone attack for 18 months. Elon Musk has reacted angrily to a ruling by a Brazilian judge that anti-democratic posts on the social media platform X should be blocked. Also in this podcast. After suffering armed robberies and running 385 marathons the length of Africa, a British runner finally ends the longest of runs. We begin in Israel. The country's defence minister says its forces have left southern Gaza to prepare for future operations, including in the town of Rafah. Following weeks of a deadly Israeli ground offensive in the city of Khan Yunis, Yoav Gallant said Hamas had now ceased to function as a military organisation there. But a spokesman for the Israel Defence Forces, Peter Lerner, says the war is far from over.
The military campaign is continuously evolving. And this is just another stage in the war effort. As we completed our mission in the Khan Yunis area, so then the troops rotate out. And we have other troops that are operating elsewhere. So it's important to understand it is a decline in the forces, but there is more operations that need to be conducted. Rafah is clearly a stronghold where there are four battalions untouched. So we need to be able to get all of the hostages back wherever they are. We need to dismantle Hamas's capabilities wherever they are, and we will immobilize our forces accordingly.
Thousands of people took to the streets of Jerusalem on Sunday night to demand that Israel's government does more to secure the release of the hostages held by Hamas in Gaza since the October the 7th attacks in southern Israel. Meanwhile, the head of the Palestinian mission to the UK, Hussam Zomlot, said the international community is not doing enough to stop Israel's operations.
Netanyahu wants a perpetual aggression on Gaza. He needs war, and if it's not even in Gaza, he's going to Lebanon, to Syria, he's provoking in the West Bank. This Prime Minister of Israel lives on aggression. The leverage of the rest of the world has not been exercised, despite all the statements we have been hearing. And still, Netanyahu is preparing for an invasion of Rafah. He has declared it many times. You know the consequences. They untold stories and suffering that would be caused if he does. They have already turned Gaza unlivable. It is unlivable. The sheer level of destruction that has occurred in Gaza is unmatched.
I spoke to our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher, who's in Jerusalem, and asked him what is his understanding regarding the announcement by Israel that it's withdrawn its ground troops from southern Gaza to prepare for future operations, including in the town of Rafah.
I think what you just played there from the IDF spokesperson obviously gives a sense of how the Israeli army is trying to portray it, not as anything that is resembling a downward turn in the war, a move perhaps towards its end, essentially a reshuffling of troops, a chance for the troops who've obviously been under intense pressure inside Gaza to rest and recuperate. I mean, that's how the US has also reacted to it. The White House national security spokesman essentially used those words, saying that he didn't believe that it was likely a gambit to prepare for a new major operation. There has been speculation in Israel that this could be a withdrawal of troops who would then be used in another operation. And the one operation that's left in terms of territory in Gaza is Rafah, the southernmost town where more than a million Palestinians, displaced Palestinians, have taken refuge.
And the Palestinian diplomat we heard there in the UK was saying the international community is not doing enough. I mean, America has been very clear about an invasion into Rafah with more than a million people, civilians, sheltering there. What mood is there, do you think, amongst Israelis and the Israeli government for that move into Rafah now?
Well, I mean, I think that's a nuanced question. The mood amongst the Israeli people, such as it can be gauged, is still support for the military campaign, but tempered very, very strongly. And we've seen that in the protests we've been taking place in the last few weeks on Saturdays, where around 100,000 people came out. And these calls are essentially in favour of trying to save the hostages who are still being held in Gaza, and the sense that the military campaign may not be achieving that. It may actually be doing the opposite. So calls for a ceasefire are based on that, not necessarily on what the Palestinians have suffered or what the international community is demanding, but in the sense that the Israeli hostages who are still in Gaza, the best solution for them is a ceasefire that would allow them, hopefully, to be released in a deal with Hamas.
Sebastian Usher in Jerusalem. Sunday marked exactly 6 months since the October the 7th attacks, which led directly to the conflict in the Gaza Strip. The Hamas-run health ministry in the territory says that over 33,000 Palestinians have been killed in the Israeli military offensive which followed. From Jerusalem, our international editor Jeremy Bowen reports.
At his cabinet meeting, Benjamin Netanyahu marked 6 months since Hamas killed around 1,200 Israelis, mostly civilians, on the 7th of October. He said Israel would complete the elimination of Hamas in all Gaza. That, Mr. Netanyahu insisted, included Rafah in the south, where 1.4 million Palestinian civilians are sheltering.
Citizens of Israel, there is no war more just than this one, and we are determined to achieve total victory to ensure that Gaza never again constitutes a threat to Israel.
I went to kibbutz near Oz, where a quarter of the 400 Israeli residents were killed or taken hostage on the 7th of October. Ron Bahat, who survived the attack, showed me the homes of friends and neighbours who did not.
Alex Danzig was kidnapped from here. Zalman Zalmanovich was abducted from here. His body is in the Gaza Strip. Gideon Pauke, they were shooting him through the door. His wife was putting a tourniquet on him, but he was bleeding to death on him.
He bled out?
Yeah.
Polls show Palestinians strongly support the attacks, but like Israelis, they tend not to believe that their side could carry out atrocities. Israel denies the allegation, considered plausible at the World Court, that it's committing genocide in Gaza. Dimitri Diliani, a Palestinian Christian activist in Jerusalem, says Israelis are deluding themselves.
Killing children is killing children. It doesn't matter who is the child that's being killed. It doesn't matter who is doing the killing. I do sympathize with the Holocaust. I recognize the Holocaust. But that does not mean a green light for Israel to commit a genocide against my people or any other people, matter of fact.
The attacks of the 7th of October put the Palestinian-Israeli conflict back at the top of the global agenda, but with both sides believing that the other has carried out inhuman, unforgivable crimes, that agenda does not include a realistic chance of peace.
Jeremy Bowen. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog has condemned a drone attack on the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia power plant in Ukraine. Rafael Grossi said there had been three direct hits on the site. Russia's nuclear agency has blamed Ukraine. There's been no comment from the government in Kyiv as we record this podcast. The International Atomic Energy Agency is based in Vienna. Bethany Bell is our correspondent there, and I asked her what the agency has said about the situation.
It says that drone attacks at Zaporizhzhia have caused damage to the building that houses one of its six reactors. It says that this was a serious incident. It says that nuclear safety, however, was not compromised. which means that there was no release of radioactive material as a result of the attack. It also said that one casualty was reported by the Russians' administrators who occupy the plant, which is the largest in Europe.
And there have been some very strong comments from the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, haven't there?
Yes, he said that this kind of incident cannot happen. He said it was a no-go. He said that it was essential that both sides did not jeopardise nuclear safety. And he said no one could benefit or gain any kind of military or political advantage from attacks against nuclear facilities. And he has warned repeatedly in the past about the dangers of military activity near a nuclear power plant. And it's interesting that we've had this sort of situation for where both Russia and Ukraine have regularly accused each other of shelling the plant and risking nuclear disaster.
Now, I understand that there are a number of IAEA monitors in and around Zaporizhia. What can they do, as far as you know, on a daily basis?
There's a small team of IAEA experts stationed in Zaporizhia. They are there to observe the situation. They have confirmed the reports by the Russian administrative people who are there. They're there to observe what is happening to the plant in terms of safety and security. But of course, when it comes to observing what is happening militarily around there, it's much harder for them because they are within the plant and have a very specific remit.
Bethany Bell. Next to Iran and a group of six conservationists who've been detained in the country since 2018 are to be released. The authorities in Tehran announced that they would be freed along with other prisoners as part of an annual pardon to mark the end of the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. The environmentalists, some of whom have dual nationality, were convicted of national security offences and one of their colleagues died in jail. James Menendez spoke to Professor Kaveh Madani, an Iranian environmental scientist and the former deputy head of Iran's Environment Department. He also knows many of the detainees. So what do we know about their release?
It's one of the best days for Iran's environment over the last few years. People are excited, although, you know, these people shouldn't have been pardoned. They should have been compensated for the a loss of opportunities for and baseless accusations and the loss of like 6 years of their lives in prison. But it's definitely a very good day.
Just remind us why they were arrested in the first place. What was the context at the time? I mean, there was a lot of pressure on the work of environmentalists in Iran at the time, wasn't there?
Yeah, it's very hard to read and understand the Islamic Republic and its security operations and why they decided to, you know, to go for the crackdown of the environmental activists at the first place. But the general thinking is that they realized how strong the environmental space is in creating unity, regardless of your ideology in Iran. Whether you support the Islamic Republic or not, if you are Shia, Sunni, Christian, or, you know, you don't believe in God, or, like, you know, it doesn't matter what your ethnicity is. You care about the environment. You care about clean air. You care about the Asiatic cheetahs and biodiversity laws in Iran. And that unprecedented power to unite people was scary for the security operations, we believe, you know, in my opinion. And that is when they came after those who were active and trying to make a change, inform the public, raise awareness, and essentially make the government accountable for the damages they were essentially creating for the environmental sector.
And this bizarre detail about using camera traps to research Asiatic cheetahs and the sort of suggestion that somehow those camera traps were part of a spying effort.
So just to tell your audience about the background story, yeah, this group was known in the world for their efforts to save the Asiatic cheetah. Only about 50 of them left in the world, and they're located in Iran. So they were trying to find where they are located, putting camera traps to study their behavior and find them. And then, yes, the security operations claimed that they were using the camera traps for monitoring the missile ballistic missile activities and nuclear activities of Iran, which turned out to be really funny to anyone who had a little bit of expertise. And later on, they changed the story, but it was too late. At the time, one of the prisoners actually suspiciously died in the Evin prison, and things became more got more escalated when once the there was a questioning by the general public about what is happening to the environmental activists.
And just one final question, and briefly if you can. I mean, do you have any theories about why this pardon has come now?
I think it's very hard to again, understand the Islamic Republic, but these people had no value for the system anymore. The dual national, the only dual national of the case had been already swapped with an American prisoner and some money. And the rest of them essentially were like their prison time was coming to an end, and keeping them there was more costly to them. Because the people of Iran kept asking what's happening to them and why these people are held over 6 years in prison without any proof of any wrongdoing.
Professor Kaveh Madani, the former deputy head of Iran's Environment Department. Next to Denmark, and in the heart of Copenhagen, the neighbourhood of Christiania has been a haven of counterculture for over 50 years. Popular with tourists, it's known for its liberal attitude towards cannabis and, most infamously, the open-air drug market, Pusher Street. But criminal gangs have increasingly taken over there, leading to rising violence. Residents are fed up, so they decided to dig up the street. Adrian Murray reports.
Armed with spades and crowbars, locals cheered and applauded as the first cobbles were prized from the ground. Watched on by a large crowd, the mood was celebratory. And stone by stone, Christiania's notorious Pusher Street was pulled apart.
It feels good. Now we are in working clothes. Now we start work and now we start stop talking, start acting.
It's closing down today, so it's the final closing party. And we're taking out the bricks. Some of them are going home for souvenirs and others are being recycled.
The last, like, 5-6 years, I haven't been here that much because I have had kids. I didn't feel, like, very safe. Today I brought all three of them and they're all helping.
Though it's illegal in Denmark, cannabis has been sold on this 100-metre stretch of road for decades, less than a kilometre from the Danish Parliament. Before today, you might find 20 dealers in this very spot, hawking weed from behind makeshift stacks of beer crates and plywood market stalls with names like Green Rocket and Blue Dream. But now, it's a totally different scene. Danish Justice Minister Peter Hummelgaard says the action is more than just symbolic.
Today is a historical day. It's the beginning of the end of the very, very deep roots that organized crime gangs have established in this neighborhood of Copenhagen.
For a long time, Christiania had resisted efforts to close Pusher Street. But this summer, residents decided it had to go. And in an extraordinary step, this once rebellious group been working together with the authorities. Hulda Mader is a community spokesperson who's lived in Christiania for 40 years.
Like 1.5 years ago, that was a real turning point. Two people came in and shot one dead and injured four others. That was absolutely where we said, this is enough. We don't want it anymore. We don't feel enriched by it in any way at all.
Local dealers have increasingly been pushed out as hardcore gangs have wrested control of the business. And in the last 3 years, there's been a spate of stabbings and fatal shootings. Police raided Pusher Street over 100 times last year, but the dealers have kept coming back. Deputy Police Inspector Simon Hansen oversees the police operation in Christiania.
I think this time it's very different because we have all parties around the table. Christiania want it. The police know how to handle it. We've tried during this winter, we tried to close down the market for a couple of days just to see what is the reaction. I have a lot of experience from when the area was closed during Corona. I think overall we are pretty prepared to handle what is going on.
Freetown Christiania was founded back in 1971 when a bunch of anarchists and hippies squatted inside a vacant military base and established a semi-autonomous commune with its own rules and flag. More than 50 years later, the commune still survives, but it's not the same hippie utopia. Today, around 1,000 people, including 250 children, live in the graffiti-covered barracks and quirky wooden cottages that are strung out along the city's leafy historic ramparts. Beyond shuttering Pusher Street, the community is taking other steps to secure its future, with new housing and investment. But some think that might change the character of Christiania. Sophie Heerstorp Andersen is Copenhagen's Lord Mayor.
Christiania has been gradually becoming older, and what Christiania needs is a revitalization with young people. When some of this crime and the gangs and the pushers are coming away from Pusher Street, I think that a lot of young creative souls will actually move into Christiania, and Christiania needs them in order to survive.
Exactly what will replace Pusher Street is still to be decided. But Holden Major tells me they want to get back to Christiania's creative roots.
We have ideas about how to build stuff and how to create new arts and make a playground and theatre and all sorts of artistic things that brings people here and shops and make it another life down in that street.
That report was by Adrian Murray. Still to come.
These measures are mainly going to be focused on low-skilled workers, so anyone wanting to come to New Zealand will have a shorter time to stay in New Zealand. They'll have tougher English tests to get there in the first place.
New Zealand is tightening its visa rules with immediate effect after the number of migrants entering the country last year reached a near record level.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast looking at the world through the lens of its media.
State media know which topics they can and can't discuss.
We fill gaps and connect dots to better understand what's happening in the world.
It's important to remember the context.
And untangle the narratives aimed at influencing your views.
Tightly controlled.
It's not so healthy to be a journalist there.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, a failure by the international community, either by contempt or by cowardice. That is the assessment of the Rwandan President Paul Kagame as he held a ceremony to mark 30 years since the genocide there in which 800,000, mostly ethnic Tutsis, were killed. Current and former world leaders have been meeting in the capital, Kigali, including Bill Clinton, who's described the genocide as the biggest failure of his US presidency. Our deputy Africa editor, Anne Soy, reports from Nairobi.
A somber ceremony in Kigali and a moment of reflection for the world, which stands accused of failing to help Rwanda in her time of need. UN peacekeepers stood by as hundreds of thousands of Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed, about a quarter of a million women raped, and families displaced. There was no external intervention to stop the bloodshed. The massacre was sparked during the civil war in 1994 when the plane carrying the Hutu president was shot down. Hutu forces then rampaged across Rwanda, and the killings were only stopped when Tutsi forces, led by Paul Kagame, took control of the country. President Kagame lit the flame of remembrance in Kigali. It will burn for the next 100 days to signify the time it took his forces to end the killings.
Rwanda was completely humbled by the magnitude of our loss. And the lessons we learned are engraved in blood.
As part of national mourning this week, flags will fly at half-mast, bars and clubs will stay closed, and local media will refrain from showing sports and films and playing music except where it's dedicated to the memorial. The message from Kigali, never forget and never repeat anywhere.
Anne Soy in Nairobi. The owner of the X social media platform, Elon Musk, has called for the resignation or impeachment of a Brazilian Supreme Court judge who ordered him to block a number of accounts. Mr. Musk says he will ignore the judge's ruling. Leonardo Rocha reports.
Mr. Musk said that the judge, Alexandre de Moraes, had repeatedly betrayed the constitution and the people of Brazil. He said that Mr. Moraes ordered the X platform, which was formerly known as Twitter, to block the accounts of individuals who post messages deemed anti-democratic. Many of them are supporters of the former right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, who called Elon Musk a true hero of Brazilian democracy. Mr. Musk said the judge had imposed heavy fines on X and threatened to arrest its employees.
Leonardo Rocha. Last year, the authorities in New Zealand reported that the number of migrants entering the country had reached a near record level. That's after a lull during the coronavirus pandemic. Now it says it is tightening its visa rules with immediate effect. Jackie Leonard spoke to our Asia Pacific regional editor, Mickey Bristow, and asked him for more about these measures.
These measures are mainly going to be focused on low-skilled workers. So anyone wanting to come to New Zealand will have a shorter time to stay in New Zealand. They'll have tougher English tests to get there in the first place. They'll also have to show that they've got proper work experience for the jobs that they want to take in New Zealand. Essentially, what the government there is saying is that it wants to balance out the needs of the economy for workers with other wider interests in New Zealand. For example, lots of immigrants coming into a country puts a pressure on infrastructure such as hospitals, schools, transport networks, that kind of thing. So the government says it wants to balance that out, reduce gradually the number of low-skilled workers coming to New Zealand and increase the amount of skilled workers, which there is still shortage of in the economy, such as secondary school teachers. So that's essentially what the government's trying to do.
And the government, the New Zealand actually elected a right-wing government last November. To what extent is this about domestic policies?
There is certainly some of that going on. As you say, last year there was an election, a right-wing government replaced the Labour government. Labour government was more amenable to immigration and they seem to have a more relaxed attitude towards it. If you look at the press release that the current government has put out, the immigration minister talks about levels being unsustainable. Political language which suggests their attitude towards immigration isn't quite the same as the previous Labour government. There is an economic change, or there has been an economic change, which is driving this as well, though. After the pandemic, there was a genuine shortage of workers in New Zealand. The economy was rebounding. It needed more workers. And so they tried, the government, to get in more workers. Those jobs have now been filled to a large extent. So there is an economic reason for the current government to restrict the number of people going to New Zealand.
Mickey Bristow. Now to some good news for one of the world's most endangered mammals, the Javan rhinoceros. A new calf has been spotted by a hidden camera at one of Indonesia's national parks. James Menendez spoke to Joe Shaw, chief executive of Save the Rhino.
Really exciting news today from the Ministry of Environment and Forestry in Indonesia that a new Javan rhino calf has been recorded for the first time as part of an ongoing program for this critically endangered species. As you've mentioned, Javan rhinos are critically endangered. There may only be 76 animals remaining. The ministry has previously reported that up to 12 of these animals may actually be missing. So very exciting that we are seeing new additions to this population.
Am I right in thinking that the Javanese rhinos, they only calve every 2 years? Is that right? So actually, this is quite a rare event.
Yeah, it's a very rare and exciting thing. We don't know very much about Javan rhinos. They probably live for about 30 or 40 years. Their gestation period is probably about 15 or 16 months. And new calves are rare. One female was recorded on camera last year and one the year before.
How protected are they in Indonesia?
Well, one of the biggest concerns for Javan rhinos is that the species now only occurs in a single park, the Ujung Kulon National Park, on the extreme southwestern tip of Java, on a peninsula that's just connected to the mainland by a very narrow isthmus. And concerningly, it's only about 35 miles across the seas from the Krakatoa volcano. So a hugely risky area for this species to be remaining in, although we're seeing great dedication from government, NGO partners and academics in the monitoring and protection of these animals.
Well, so there's an environmental threat. Is there also a threat from man, from trafficking, poaching?
Yes, yeah, so all five species of rhinos around the world have been threatened by habitat loss over time. The remaining animals just occur in fragmented populations. But additionally, they are actively persecuted by human interventions and trafficking of their horns by transnational organised crime networks.
Just tell us a little bit about what it looks like, because it's quite well known for this sort of armour-plated look. Is that right?
Yes, the Javan rhino is closely related to the greater one-horned or Indian rhino, and they both have these almost armour-plating plates around the body, giving them this tank-like or prehistoric appearance.
That was Joe Shaw from Save the Rhino. Now, for most people, running one marathon is quite enough. But a British 27-year-old man has decided to take this one step further, running a total of 385 across the entire length of Africa, becoming the first person ever to do so. And after just under a year travelling across the continent, he has finally reached the finish line in Tunisia. Caris Maidment reports.
In January last year, 27-year-old Russ Cook from Southeast England, otherwise known as the hardest geezer online, revealed his challenge to the world. He was going to run the entire length of Africa, all in the aid of charity. And more than 16,000 kilometres, 352 days and 16 countries later, he's reached the finish line in the most northern tip of Tunisia. He's managed to raise just short of $1 million, but his mission has been far from smooth sailing. Only a few months in, Cook made headlines here in the UK as he and his support team were robbed at gunpoint in Angola.
I don't think I was that worried about getting shot, but in that moment, you're trying to assess the guy to see how much of a threat he really is. He's just going to take things, we're just going to have to allow it.
Back on the road, the physical impact of running 385 marathons was starting to take its toll. Food poisoning and urinating blood were just some of the ailments he had to put up with. But it was pain in his lower back that threatened to stop everything.
It feels like there's some kind of nerve thing going on there.
No, the nerve is probably not there for nothing. Like, probably if you're going to keep on doing what you're doing, you're probably going to... You might be walking towards an operation and losing mobility in your back.
But no amount of painkillers can beat bureaucracy. He was forced to pause his mission after visa issues prevented him from crossing into Algeria. By this point, Cook had built up quite the following on social media and took to X, formerly known as Twitter, to ask the Algerian government for support.
If you're listening, Algeria, please help us. It's quite hard knowing that, like, the entire fate of the mission kind of depends on how well this video lands.
It gained the attention of the platform's founder Elon Musk, British MPs, and, most importantly, the British Embassy in Algeria, who tweeted him back to say his visa had been granted. After nearly a full year on the road, Russ Cook's journey has come to an end. How he plans on celebrating, you ask? With none other than a strawberry daiquiri.
Caris Maidment there. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Wayne Moses. The producer is Liam McSheffrey. The editor, Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast looking at the world through the lens of its media.
State media know which topics they can and can't discuss.
We fill gaps and connect dots to better understand what's happening in the world.
It's important to remember the context.
And untangle the narratives aimed at influencing your views.
Tightly controlled.
It's not so healthy to be a journalist there.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.